Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 255. It's Monday, April 29th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's start up with a landmark story, this from Medical Express. Premature mortality higher among sexual minority women, study finds. Compared to heterosexual women, bisexual women died 37% sooner and lesbian women 20% sooner, according to results from one of the largest studies to examine sexual orientation-related inequities in mortality and the first to differentiate between lesbians and bisexual women. The findings were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Decades of research have documented that sexual minority women have worse health across various physical and mental health outcomes relative to their heterosexual peers. However, few studies have examined inequities in mortality, and none have been able to differentiate mortality inequities among sexual minority subgroups in women. The sexual orientation-related inequities in mortality highlight the urgent need to address preventable causes, particularly given the increasingly hostile policy climate for LGBTQ people in the U.S., said lead author Sarah McKetta, research fellow at the Harvard Healthcare Institute. Dr. McKetta adds, LGBTQ people are subjected to unique forms of stigma, prejudice, and discrimination that get under the skin in a myriad of ways. These toxic social forces result in chronic stress and unhealthy coping mechanisms, which make this population vulnerable to worse health and premature mortality. The researchers used data from the Nurses' Health Study, a cohort of over 100,000 female nurses born between 1945 and 1964, and surveyed prospectively since 1989. Eligible participants are those alive in 1995 when sexual orientation was first assessed. The study team linked participant-reported sexual orientation to nearly 30 years of death records. Results showed that sexual minority women died, on average, 26% sooner than heterosexual women. These disparities were driven by both bisexual women who died 37% sooner and lesbian women who died 20% sooner. The ability to stratify results by sexual orientation subgroup, researchers say, was a key strength to the study. Bisexual women face distinct stressors from outside as well as within the LGBTQ community that are rooted in biphobia. Additionally, bisexual people are often excluded from various communities because they're assumed to be straight or gay based on their partner's gender, said senior author Brittany Charlton, Harvard Medical School Associate Professor of Population Medicine. The more pronounced premature mortality rate among bisexual women is troubling and underscores the need for targeted interventions to reduce these disparities among all sexual minority groups. The researchers make suggestions for actionable first steps that can be implemented through the care continuum. They include evidence-based preventive screening for sexual minority women without assumptions based on identity, increased screening and treatment referral for tobacco, alcohol, and other substance use, and mandatory culturally informed training for healthcare providers caring for sexual minority patients. While our findings are striking on their own, they just might underscore the true disparity in the United States population. Study participants were all nurses and therefore may have protective factors that the general population doesn't. It's imperative that we work to address the systems and structures that undermine the well-being and dignity of LGBTQ people. Amen to that. Okay, well, next up we're going to go to an LA Times piece on public health and the economy. And of course, during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a lot of discussion about really posing the economy and public health as somehow opposed to each other. But of course, you cannot have a economically healthy country without healthy workers and a larger population. So this, how the U.S. economy depends on public health. American life expectancy started dropping even before the pandemic. It's a critical barometer of our nation's health and a sign that all is not well in the U.S. Much of the increase in preventable premature death is attributable to drug overdose, which increased fivefold over the last couple decades. But this malaise is far broader, driven largely by growing chronic illnesses. Rates of depression are reaching new highs. Obesity rates among adults have risen from 30% to 42% since the turn of the century, with severe obesity nearly doubling and driving up the risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other serious health conditions. The return of vaccine-preventable illnesses has been a concern since the 2010s. Sexually transmitted infections have surged in the last decade, and for the first time since 1937, an infectious disease, COVID-19, became one of the top three causes of death in the country. These health problems are alarming on their own. They also have a devastating impact on our economy. A one-year increase in life expectancy could boost economic output by 4%. On the other hand, as Americans' health declines, our health expenditures continue to soar. As a country, we spend $4.5 trillion annually on health, representing 17% of GDP. Out-of-pocket health care costs have risen dramatically, straining workers' finances and pushing people into bankruptcy. All this fuels a cycle of a sicker workforce and a weaker economy. Policymakers acknowledge the link between the economy and public health at the height of the pandemic, providing federal relief programs such as cash assistance and paid sick leave designed to keep the nation's workforce and economy as healthy as possible. But our abandonment of these efforts since getting COVID relatively under control sets our country up for mounting crises. We need to revive a historical source of support for public health measures, the business case for a healthy workforce. In 1842, Edwin Chadwick argued in his landmark Report on the Sanitary Conditions of the Laboring Population in Great Britain that public health investments are crucial not only from a moral perspective, but also for economic productivity. Writing for The Atlantic in 1909, C.E.A. Winslow, an American public health pioneer, wrote that employers who try welfare measures for workers, quote, find that it pays. And around that time, Wycliffe Rose, an American philanthropist, oversaw the Rockefeller Sanitary Commission to tackle hookworm disease as a controllable health problem, spurring economic productivity. Hookworm, which can cause anemia and fatigue and impair development in children, was a significant problem in southern states in the late 1800s and early 1900s, resulting from lack of access to clean water, poor sanitation, and poor hygiene. Its symptoms were blamed on, quote, laziness, a stigma often attached today to symptoms of chronic illnesses, disabilities, and mental health issues, and perpetuated cycles of poverty. Rose all but eradicated hookworm through education campaigns, expanding access to treatment, and improving public sanitation. Similarly, during World War II, the U.S. government invested in public health initiatives to curb the transmission of malaria in tropical and subtropical battlefronts, vaccinate against smallpox, typhoid fever, and tetanus, and control sexually transmitted infections, which during World War I cost the U.S. Army more than 7 million work days and 10,000 preventable discharges. When it functions well, such public health infrastructure makes it easier for working people to lead healthy lives. The results have been dramatic, contributing in the last century to the average human lifespan doubling around the world. Despite the impression given by COVID-19, public health has historically been about so much more than tracking disease outbreaks. It's been about preventing disease. Access to health care and insurance play a role, but doctors and hospitals most often come into play after someone is already sick. Research shows that simple resources such as clean air and water, affordable healthy food, stable housing, and safe workplaces are much better predictors of good health and longevity. During the pandemic, programs addressing basic needs, eviction freezes, expanded food assistance, and mandated paid sick and family leave for employees in smaller companies enhanced housing stability, curbed COVID spread, and protected Americans' mental health. Since then, home affordability has plummeted. Half of American renters spend more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities. In 2022, more than 40 million Americans lived in food insecure households, adding to health issues in adults and children. The U.S. is one of the only high-income nations that still lacks universal paid sick leave and family medical leave, forcing many people to go to work sick or risk losing a day's wages. Interventions to improve workplace air quality, a vital component of a healthy workplace, appreciated even by 19th and 20th century health reformers, have been overlooked. The pandemic-era measures were dropped in part because of their cost. But what is much more expensive and what is causing American workers needless suffering as our national health declines is our current approach to health. Of our $4.5 trillion annual health spending in the U.S., the vast majority goes to treating people when they are already sick. Only 4% supports programs to keep people and workers healthy in the first place. This focus on treating individuals after they have already fallen ill is much of the reason we pay dramatically more than other countries, yet still have some of the worst health indicators in the world. Once again, treating public health as an economic imperative could help broaden support for the type of interventions that become polarizing during the pandemic, but have a long track record of improving well-being and productivity. So, well, I'm not a big fan of turning everything into money and economic activity. It's irrefutable that a sick workforce and a sick population definitely degrades the ability to have a healthy economy. And of course, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So investments up front in prevention, whether it's things like social determinants of food security, housing support, mandated sick leave, all of these types of things can lead to a healthier population and a healthier economy. Okay, well, next up we're going to move to something that is a well-known signature of public health, that is vaccines, this from Vox. How many lives have vaccines saved? New WHO study comes out with a breathtaking estimate. The world has become a much safer place to be a young child in the last 50 years. Since 1974, infant mortality worldwide has plummeted. That year, 1 in 10 newborns died before reaching their first birthday. By 2021, that rate had fallen by over two-thirds. A lot of factors drove this change. Lower poverty and better nutrition, cleaner air and water, and readily available antibiotics and other treatments. But one of the biggest contributors, a new study from the WHO concludes, was vaccines. Vaccines alone, the researchers find, accounted for 40% of the decline in infant mortality. The paper, authored by a team of researchers led by WHO epidemiologist and vaccine expert Nayar Barziv, estimates that in the 50 years since 1974, vaccines prevented 154 million deaths. Of that 154 million, 146 million lives saved were among children under five. Wow, that's stunning. And this includes 101 million infants. Because the averted deaths were so concentrated among young people, who on average would go on to live for 66 years, vaccines gave their beneficiaries an astonishing 9 billion additional years of life. The paper was commissioned on the 50th anniversary of the WHO's expanded program on immunization, which launched in 1974 to build on the success of the agency's work eradicating smallpox. It covers a critical period of time. The previous decades had seen a spree of important, newly developed vaccines. A joint diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine in 1948, a polio vaccine in 1955, a measles vaccine in 1963. While rolled out quickly in wealthy countries, these immunizations were, as of 1974, not broadly available in the global south, even as the diseases they prevented wreaked massive damage. Over the ensuing half-century, through vaccination campaigns led by the WHO and later Gavi, a multilateral group formerly called the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, that radically changed. In sub-Saharan Africa in 2021, 68% of one-year-olds received a first dose of the measles vaccine, 78% received the TB vaccine, and about 70% received the vaccines against hepatitis B, polio, and diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, the DPT vaccine. This progress yielded massive gains. The measles vaccine in particular deserves pride of place in this story. The research included that it averted almost 94 million deaths from 1974 onward, accounting for the most deaths averted by vaccines in general. In terms of lives saved, the runners-up, tetanus at 28 million lives saved, pertussis at 13 million lives, and tuberculosis at 11 million lives, pale in comparison. Stamping out measles through vaccination enabled to go from an omnipresent, fast-spreading lethal threat to a relic of the past, though anti-vaccine activists threatened to undo some of that progress. The data is a reminder that vaccines have historically been one of our best tools for saving lives, and that redoubling efforts to discover and distribute new ones for diseases like malaria and tuberculosis could have a similarly transformative effect. And of course, anti-vaccine activists like to focus on side effects, but if you look at the primary effect of vaccines saving millions of lives a year over the last 50 years, it's a stunning accomplishment. Okay, next up, switching gears to another example of public health recognizing an emerging epidemic, that is of loneliness. This from Medical Express. Survey finds loneliness epidemic runs deep among parents. A new national survey conducted by the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center finds that a broad majority of parents experience isolation, loneliness, and burnout from the demands of parenthood, with many feeling a lack of support in fulfilling that role. The survey of parents conducted this month found about two-thirds felt the demands of parenthood sometimes or frequently feel isolating and lonely. About 62% feel burned out by their responsibilities as a parent. Nearly 2 in 5, that is 38%, feel they have no one to support them in their parenting role. Nearly 4 in 5, 79%, would value a way to connect with other parents outside of work and home. Loneliness has been shown to affect both your physical and mental health, so anything from cardiovascular disease to depression, anxiety, cognitive decline, even your immune system can be affected when you're lonely. In fact, one study showed that if you're in social isolation for a prolonged amount of time, it can be equivalent to smoking about 15 cigarettes a day. So parenting, particularly of young children, can be a particularly vulnerable amount of time and needs a lot of support. Loneliness just being one thing, unfortunately, in our society, which is the most individualistic, we could use more social supports. Okay, next up, a story on school-age kids. This from Medical Express. New school lunch rules target added sugars and salt. School lunches will soon contain less added sugars and salt under new nutrition standards announced by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We all share the goal of helping children reach their full potential, said Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Like teachers, classrooms, books, and computers, nutritious school meals are an essential part of the school environment. And when we raise the bar for school meals, it empowers our kids to achieve greater success inside and outside of the classroom. The new standards will be implemented over the next few years. Schools serve breakfast and lunch to nearly 30 million children every school day. These meals are the main source of nutrition for more than half of these children, according to the USDA. I'm going to report that again. So these meals, meaning school breakfasts and lunches, are the main source of nutrition for more than half of those children. The changes are the first significant reform of school meal standards since the passage of the 2010 Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. The Biden administration has also created a national strategy to end hunger and reduce diet-related disease by 2030. History suggests the moves will work. A 2023 study found that changes that took place during the Obama administration to push more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and low-fat dairy products significantly decreased kids and teens' body mass index. Current dietary guidelines recommend limiting added sugars to less than 10% of daily calorie intake, but data from the 2014 and 15 school year found the average school lunch had 11% added sugars and breakfast had 17% added sugars. Beginning in the 25-26 school year, certain products, including breakfast cereals, yogurt, and flavored milk, will have specific limits on added sugars. By the 2027-2028 school year, weekly meal calories will be capped at 10% added sugars. The final rule requires one 15% cut in sodium in lunches and one 10% cut in sodium in breakfast by the 2027-2028 school year. The new standards are an important step forward, Nancy Brown, chief executive of the American Heart Association, said. Added sugars are a significant source of excess calories, provide no nutritional value, and may cause weight gain and increased risk for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other chronic health conditions. We are thrilled to see the USD has followed the recommendation from a 2022 citizen petition from the American Heart Association and other public health groups to include an added sugar standard in this final rule. However, we are disappointed that the USDA did not establish an added sugars product limit for grain-based desserts, such as cereal bars, donuts, and toaster pastries, as originally proposed, and that the whole grain standard does not fully align with the dietary guidelines for Americans. In addition, we are discouraged that the final rules make only slight reductions in sodium and does not require more significant sodium reductions over time. So, big move forward. Still more room to improve. Okay, well, next up, an international survey that measures trust in societies. And for the U.S. And worldwide, we're actually seeing declines, but the U.S. is on the more distrustful side. This from Axios. Trust in health institutions declines as more rely on their own judgment. Declining confidence in major institutions is driving more people to trust their own ability to assess health information or turn to friends for guidance, indicates a new global Edelman Trust Barometer survey provided exclusively to Axios. Why it matters? Lack of trust in public health agencies, nonprofits, and the media is emerging as an enduring legacy of the COVID-19 pandemic, and it has huge implications for how we respond to the next big disease threat or even manage our day-to-day health. The growing rise of, quote, health empowerment is a double-edged sword. It can make people more engaged stewards of their own care, but can also leave them vulnerable to rising health misinformation that's become a major threat. The rise of empowerment is potentially something great, said Richard Edelman, CEO of the global communications firm, but without it being balanced with some form of trust in institutions, trust in expertise, if it's all self-reliance, it's like giving a kid the keys to the car and saying, go drive. The big picture, the U.S. is far from alone in the political fracturing and rising skepticism that characterize our own COVID-19 response, suggests the survey of 15,000 people across the U.S. and 15 different countries. Fears about the politicization of medical science has shot up, rising 13 percentage points in the past year to 64%. That puts it on par with concerns about healthcare affordability and the possibility of another pandemic. 4 in 10 said they have regretted a health decision they made based on misinformation at least once, with higher rates among younger populations. They said the top source of misinformation was a product advertisement, followed by friends and families, and then user-generated content. 41% of adults aged 18 to 34 say they wouldn't trust their doctor or would drop them if they don't have the same political or social views. That was 35% for people 35 to 54 and 18% for those 55 plus. So as trust declines, there's a growing space for misinformation to grow. Be on the lookout. Be media savvy. It doesn't take much misinformation to start a conspiracy theory. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, while here in the United States, we suffer from being the most individualized culture ever on the planet, but there are actually collective moves afoot. This from Axios. CVS pharmacy workers move to unionize. Pharmacists at CVS stores are moving to join a new union as part of a growing backlash to what they say are unsafe working conditions. Why it matters? The new unionization effort comes months after pharmacy workers at major retail stage walkouts, dubbed Pharmageddon, in response to understaffing and growing workplace demands that they warn are putting patients' health at risk. The Pharmacy Guild, which launched late last year following the nationwide walkouts, is the first union dedicated to representing pharmacies. Thousands of pharmacy workers, including CVS and Walgreens employees, have also unionized with other groups like the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. The Pharmacy Guild said there are ongoing efforts to unionize more pharmacies across the country. So, unite and collectively bargain.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up I have a story, a marker for the long unwinding of the COVID pandemic. This from Axios. Turning point, COVID-era hospital reporting set to end. Hospitals starting this week will no longer have to report data on admissions, occupancy, and other indicators of possible system stress from respiratory diseases to federal officials as another COVID-era mandate expires. Why it matters? The sunset of reporting requirements on May 1st marks a turning point in the government's real-time tracking of airborne pathogens that help drive coronavirus surveillance and reports like the Centers for Disease Control Prevention's FluView. It comes as U.S. COVID hospitalizations are around the lowest level since the start of the pandemic, but as a new variant called KP2 is rapidly spreading in multiple regions. Federal officials since March 2020 collected data from hospitals and states to understand healthcare system stress, capabilities, and capacities. Beyond COVID-19, the information helped guide prevention and response efforts to seasonal flu and RSV, which can also place a serious burden on emergency departments and ICUs. The government stopped or scaled back other data reporting at the end of the public health emergency, covering metrics like daily new COVID cases and test positivity. That has left wastewater surveillance and hospital admissions as some of the most effective barometers of disease spread. So we lose another one with hospital admissions. And of course, this is all of the respiratory infections. Because if you're trying to sort COVID out of those, you have to, you know, deal with the other ones. And of course, flu and RSV have been ongoing problems. An interesting part about this story, besides the phase out of surveillance of these respiratory diseases down to a much less level, is that a lot of this is really geared towards the overburdening of the medical system, which is kind of a, high bar or low bar, depending how you look at it. High bar in the sense of how much problem you need to pay attention to it, that you're overrunning hospitals, versus a more rigorous bar that public health might have in wanting to have surveillance on a whole variety of respiratory pathogens, how they're moving. So if you're looking out and you can get the weather report every day, but you have no idea what the flu is doing or RSV or COVID, it makes it difficult for communities and individuals to make choices based on that as well. And of course, surveillance is one of the basic functions of public health. You have to help assess and identify a problem before you can adequately and effectively respond to it. So the last story in the regular reporting here gets at one of those. And this is a surveillance that can actually engage citizens, concerned citizens. This from the Environmental Health Network. New database simplifies environmental research. A new platform, fencelinedata.org, enables easy access to information on companies emitting harmful chemicals and contributing to climate change, aimed to aid journalists, advocates, and the public. Fencelinedata.org consolidates multiple government databases, allowing users to search by zip code, substance, or company for data on chemical and greenhouse gas emissions and enforcement actions. The tool focuses on serving fence line communities, those living near significant pollution sources, and provides detailed emission data and health impact information. Users can easily investigate the environmental compliance of nearby facilities, identifying potential local health risks. Why this matters? Transparency fosters accountability. When companies know that their emissions data is accessible to the public, they are more likely to adhere to environmental regulations and strive for cleaner production methods. This accountability can help mitigate the adverse effects of pollution on public health and the environment. So go, ye citizen activists, and clean up your communities. Make these corporate polluters accountable. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you'll know more than 99% of the population about public health. And should this not turn out to be true, I'd be happy to refund triple your money. Okay, next up, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 38 bonus articles this week, so let's get rolling. First up, let's deal with the single largest preventable cause of death, tobacco. Biden administration punts menthol cigarette rule indefinitely. This is an ongoing reporting. They've been dealing with this regulation for basically banning menthol and other flavored cigarettes. Menthol cigarettes are used way disproportionately in the black community, and flavored cigarettes are also targeted towards young people to make cigarette smoking more desirable or less unpleasant. And of course, once you get people hooked on nicotine, then they're off to the races of ill health. So Biden administration in an election year seems to not want to deal with this, afraid that it's going to upset some smokers, particularly black smokers. Bonus article two. On the tobacco front as well, Minneapolis City Council passes tobacco ordinance that sets $15 minimum price for cigarettes. That would be the most expensive cigarettes in the nation. Way to go, Minneapolis. And of course, smoking is price sensitive, particularly for young people who may be starting, are much more susceptible to price pressure. So this is a great way to get young people not to smoke. Now, of course, some of your adult smokers who can get around a little bit better may go to outlying communities and buy cigarettes, cheaper cigarettes from someplace else. That's likely to happen. And one of the reasons why, when we have public policy, it should not be this piecemeal thing by city or even sometimes state, depending on the policy. that you have a policy that can make sure that people can't work around it themselves as individuals. Bonus article 3, tire toxicity faces fresh scrutiny after salmon die-offs. So there was a big salmon die-off, and people were investigating what that was due to, and they found a particular chemical that happens to be found in tires. Now, part of the problem is that tires are produced by private companies who have proprietary formulas of what goes into their rubber, so it's hard to track this down or control that. But it's another example of the chemical toxicity that we're producing in our society that's leading to biological effects. And if salmon are dying off, they're like the canary in the coal mine, you know, it's probably not good for us either. Bonus article 4, big oil and gas industry's dangerous secret of radioactive waste. So several decades ago, waste from like fracking and such was actually declared non-toxic just by fiat. So that really let off the hook regulations for big oil and gas industry as far as what waste they have. But there is radioactivity that's present deep in the ground, and that's brought to the surface by fracking and drilling. And this is particularly dangerous for those people working in the oil and gas industry. But of course, once you bring it to the surface, it contaminates the rest of our world. Bonus article 5, 10 times as much of this neurotoxic pesticide could end up in your tomatoes and celery under a new EPA proposal, which ignores the official recommendation. So they have official advisory groups of scientists and such who are experts who make recommendations. The EPA chose not to follow that, and we may see more of this neurotoxic pesticide on our foods. Bonus article 6, USDA tells producers to reduce salmonella in certain frozen chicken products. So salmonella is basically a really nasty bug that can actually even be lethal or very serious. That's a side effect of eating things that are nearby chicken butts. Bonus article 7, U.S. air pollution worst in 25 years as new environmental regulations are finalized. So while air pollution continues to get worse, and it's the worst it's been in a quarter century in the U.S., the U.S. EPA has passed new environmental regulations that will tighten down on some of that. Hopefully, we can turn that ship back around. We had many decades from the 70s after the Clean Air Act was passed where pollution got better, but we've been reversing for quite a while here. Bonus article 8, researchers identify connection between air pollutants and allergic diseases. So this is not surprising because air pollutants, the toxicity they have, are dangerous to our skin and mucous membranes, which is our first line of defense immunologically, and they protect our body, basically our body barrier. And if you've got toxicity in air pollutants getting our skin and such, then it makes us more susceptible to allergic diseases, whether that's our skin or, say, our lungs, for instance. Bonus article 9, bioplastics as harmful as traditional plastics. So this is really because so industry wants to make things green, and so they think that doing bioplastics is received by consumers better than traditional plastics. But basically the same processes and all the toxic additives you have to add basically really make it impossible to distinguish the harmful nature of either bioplastics or, quote, traditional plastics. Bonus article 10, bioplastics create a composting conundrum. So this is because, again, there's a mix, and it's very hard for somebody who's trying to compost to sort out what toxic materials may get in your compost. And if you're putting toxic materials in your compost, well then, you know, you're definitely going upstream as far as being able to mitigate the toxicities of plastics and gain the advantages of composting. Bonus article 11, what you eat could alter your unborn children and grandchildren's genes and health outcomes. So I've talked about this before. It's a wonderful thing called epigenetics. It's the material that's actually found around your DNA, but these genes are upregulate and downregulate hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of processes that affect our body and our health. You can sort of think of the DNA as the hardware and the epigenetic material as the software, and there are different settings you can have for your software that impact us. And when, particularly, say, a mom eats a certain way up to their life before and including during their pregnancy, the upregulation or downregulation of this epigenetic material can affect not only their children, but even the children's children, their grandchildren. So this is kind of a rolling average of either good health or bad health that gets passed on in contiguous generations. Bonus article 12. Forever chemicals are known for lingering in the body. Menstruation helps expel them. So you're going to have some forever chemicals that are running around in your blood. And if you do a bloodletting through either menstruation or a bloodletting of giving blood, or I suppose unintentionally losing blood in an accident or something, you can actually have an outlet for forever chemicals. This could be one of the things I've tried to look, and it seems that actually donating blood may actually be good for you, and this may be one of the reasons why. Bonus article 13. Detoxifying masculinity, how men's groups reshape attitudes. So another type of toxicity is toxic masculinity, and this article talks about men's groups that have tried to help change attitudes of men. Men actually, while are a toxicity to those around them, other men and women particularly, they also harm themselves by a lack of help-seeking behaviors and poor coping mechanisms for stress and the like. Bonus article 14, women caregivers are stressed. Transportation infrastructure could help. So this is a special roles in helping that women tend to have a disproportionate burden, and it also gets at a social determinant of transportation infrastructure. So being able to get around to do all the things that you need to do is very important, and women who are doing a lot of the, you know, the soccer mom stuff, for instance, as one sort of stereotypical example, just getting around, transportation can help. Bonus article 15, how treatment of miscarriage is upending the abortion debate. So, of course, this is the tragic cases of women who are miscarrying and having their own health threatened and unable to get the adequate care, and their lives are at risk because there's a lot of nefarious and ill-defined limits upon abortion care in many states in the U.S. And in a related article, bonus article 16, EMTALA, a vital health law you've never heard of, is in danger. So this is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act of 1986, I believe, been around for a long time. And this is the law that requires that when you go into an emergency room for any reason and you need to have your health stabilized, you might be in great risk of death or disability, they have to stabilize you if they want to, say, transfer you or something. They basically have to treat you. So this is being put in danger really for the first time by these anti-abortion laws, the ones that particularly don't have any exception for the health of the mother, which can be very, very dangerous. And of course, part of the legal question is, if there's an exception for these laws, what does it mean for kind of the slippery slope of other conditions or situations that might be broken in this EMTALA protection? Bonus article 17, the grim reality of relocating to get access to gender-affirming care. So as more and more states are banning gender-affirming care, people are actually having to move to be able to get the care that they need. So this, I find interesting, kind of falls under the umbrella of things I'm keeping an eye on as far as the blue and red civil war that's happening. I think there's going to be a sorting out of the population as blue and red states become more and more different. People will be making decisions about where they live, work, and play based on those social realities. Bonus article 18, Soldiers charged with violent crimes will now face more scrutiny before they can simply leave the army. So there is discretion of the commanders to simply let somebody leave the army without having, dishonorable discharge or having that violent crime kind of attached, you know, being labeled as somebody who's committed a violent crime. And of course, that just sort of passes the buck when they leave the army. So that's being tightened up. Bonus Article 19. Lawsuit alleges Obamacare plan switching scheme targeted low-income consumers. So this is really nasty. This is an illegal scheme, which actually they've learned more about, where they've even put out these like fake ads that gain information, you know, saying, oh, you need a subsidy for healthcare. They gather the information, then they illegally use that to switch these ACA plans for somebody without their knowledge, because these insurance agents actually get commissions every time they do that. Nasty. Criminal. Bonus Article 20. You've covered your copayment. Now brace yourself for the facility fee. I wish this was just nickel and diming, but in healthcare, it's more like $10 bills and $20 bills and $100 bills. Bonus Article 21. 25-year decline in heart failure deaths has been undone, led by people under 45. So this is another example of the fact that really every ensuing generation has been less healthy than the preceding generation. Pretty much for anybody who's alive today, every generation after that has been less healthy. This is partly, I think, because we have a more toxic environment now, both socially, chemically, and those people that have lived part of their lives, particularly the early part of their lives, outside of that window of toxicity, actually live longer. But younger people who've lived more of their life and all of their life in an increasingly toxic social and chemical environment are seeing health problems increase, and we're seeing many more severe health problems in younger people, 45 or 50. Bonus Article 22, quiet. Our loud world is making us sick. So this is one of my pet peeves, is noise pollution. And in fact, it has a big effect. And this is a good kind of article to review those. But honing down in a more specific thing on noise, Bonus Article 23, study argues traffic noise is a novel risk factor for cardiovascular diseases. So they're saying even when you control for everything else, that traffic noise on top of it actually increases your chance for heart disease. Interesting. 24, rise and grind. Working late and volatile hours may lead to depression and illness. So this is an example of the healthiness of our work environment. If we've got late hours, different shifts, and volatile hours, it can definitely impact our health and lead to depression and other illness. Bonus Article 25. Study highlights heavy global burden of infectious diseases. So globally, 28% of death and disability is due to infectious disease overall, and that moves up to 44% for kids under 5, which relates to the vaccine story that I did before, that saying kids, younger kids were much more advantaged by vaccines since they deal with infectious diseases. So just an example, we thought that we moved into the chronic disease era, but infectious diseases are still very prevalent and a great burden globally. Bonus Article 26, global measles cases nearly doubled in 1 year. So just another example of infectious disease and the fact that measles, particularly one of the most infectious diseases in the world, has doubled worldwide. It's going up in the U.S., but it's much more rare in the U.S., but many of the cases that happened in the U.S. and the outbreaks are actually seeded by people doing international travel. So the more measles you have out in the world, when people are returning back to the U.S., you seed, and if you don't have enough vaccination in the community, you can have outbreaks. Bonus Article 27. 1 in 5 samples of pasteurized milk had bird flu virus fragments, FDA says. So this was a lot higher than what they're expecting, and this is a representative sample of the milk in the U.S. Now, these are virus fragments. They're not active, they don't have the ability to infect you with the bird flu because they're basically dead virus fragments. But basically, it's a measure of how many cows are being infected with bird flu, and it seems to be more than we originally thought. Which leads to the next article, bonus article 28. Are we testing enough for H5N1, which is the technical name for bird flu? And this is a good article. It's just an overview of what we need to do to prepare and keep a vigilant lookout, surveillance for the bird flu. And we'll tag another one on the bird flu one here. Bonus article 29. There's never a good time to drink raw milk, but now's a really bad time as bird flu infects cows. So raw milk has actually become increasingly dangerous in recent decades. It's never been safe. That's why you do pasteurization to kill off microbes that can infect you and make you sick or kill you. But now that we have a fairly prevalent bird flu that are infecting cows, and that's been, if you're talking about 1 in 5 samples having bird flu virus fragments, that means if you're not getting it pasteurized, those could be live bird flu, relatively dangerous there. Bonus article 30, sluggish uptake of new antibiotics threatens future development and supply for highly resistant infections. So basically what this article is saying is that there's been new improved antibiotics in recent years, but clinicians are not actually starting to use those. They're using older ones that maybe don't work as well or have more side effects or aren't able to treat the new highly resistant infections. And this doesn't bode well for the fact that there's a challenge to develop new antibiotics as it is. But if you look at the social and clinical infrastructure that we have in our healthcare system, we're not actually adopting the new behaviors in order to keep up with these highly resistant infections. So antimicrobial resistance is a big issue, and we need to have a workforce and a healthcare system that is actually rolling with the punches as these new highly resistant infections become more and more common. Bonus article 31, understaffed nursing homes more likely to use antipsychotics as chemical restraints. Yeah, that's just a kind way of saying doping up old people. So when somebody is problematic or trouble, you just give them some antipsychotics to settle them down. Of course, understaffed nursing homes have less people power to deal with the needs of their patients, so you just dope them up. And that's a specific one that infects understaffed nursing homes a lot more, but this is very common across nursing homes. And bonus article 32 is antipsychotics pose new risks for people with dementia. This is an AARP article that goes over a whole range of risks that these antipsychotics pose and more reasons why you shouldn't be willy-nilly prescribing these, and specifically for people that might have dementia. Bonus article 33, dozens of deaths reveals risk of injecting sedatives into people restrained by police. So this is an AP investigation where they found that people that were under arrest were sedated in order to be restrained, and dozens of them have died. Bonus article 34, states botched more executions of black prisoners. So black and brown folks, this just kind of bookends the entire litany of disproportionately bad things that are happening to black and brown folks in the criminal justice system, so-called criminal justice system. Because from being over-policed to being arrested to being tried to being convicted to getting probation or parole to being, you know, imprisoned to being released, and even people that are executed, those are being botched by more often black prisoners. Bonus article 35, drug and alcohol abuse goes untreated in many ex-prisoners. So as many as 85% of people leaving prisons have some kind of drug or alcohol use problem. And it's really not a great way to be treating people with drug and alcohol problems. Is a lot of those original crimes are related to the drug and alcohol use. So just locking people up is probably the exact worst thing you can do for treating people with substance use problems. And bonus article 36 gets at basic mental health issues. difficult lives explain depression better than broken brains. So this is actually fairly intuitive for people who think about it, but the biomedical kind of overly medical approach that we have to health problems, including depression and other mental health problems, is we think of it as a biochemical problem in the brain, between your ears, so to speak, when actually the toxicity is coming from society. And if we are burdened by a lot of difficulties in our life, that's actually a much better model to understand depression than thinking it's just some biochemical accident. Bonus article 37. How hot is too hot? New weather forecasting tool can help figure that out. So surveillance is part of public health, and this is a new tool that you can use when you check the weather. You can go to this online tool and it'll tell you, it'll grade it by color, how extreme heat is going to be for a particular region, and you can plan accordingly. And last but not least, bonus article 38, opioids came for country music, it's fighting back. So this is a nice Rolling Stone article. Artists have long been known for addressing social issues. And when your personal experience includes opioids in the music industry or your families and all that kind of stuff, artists are writing and fighting back. Way to go, country music. Way to go, artists. So if you'd like to read this or any of the other articles I've reported on this or any previous show, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-